Welcome back. Thank you for stopping by. I'm Henrik from Sweden, and we are always so grateful to have you with us and that you want to spend some of your time with us as we learn about why things are the way they are. RedIceCreations.com is the website. Please take a look if you're new to the program. We have a lot of material there for you. We have a return visit from Brandon Martinez today from Non-Aligned Media. He's an independent writer and journalist from Canada who specializes in foreign policy issues, international affairs, and 20th and 21st century history. For years, he has written on Zionism, Israel-Palestine, American and Canadian foreign policy, war, terrorism, and deception in the media and politics. For this program, we are going to look at last year's migration invasion and put that into perspective and discuss why it's happening, who's behind it, and who is benefiting from it. We are later in the program going to tie all of this together with the developments in Syria and look at the bigger geopolitical situation that is causing all of these pieces to fall in place the way they have. Stay tuned. Welcome back, Brandon. Thank you so much for coming back again. Always a pleasure speaking with you. Excellent to have you back.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me again.
You bet. Well, we received some good email last time you were on talking about the ISIS conspiracy. And, you know, I've been pretty bad, I guess, at keeping up with the geopolitical developments in Syria and now also how Russia, Turkey, and of course the U.S.-Israeli alliance have benefited from what is happening in the Middle East right now. Really, I've been just so busy trying to deal with the horrifying effects of this in Europe. But obviously, we do have a route to this right. Problem that everything is piggybacked on. And I think that you have some good insight on this that we definitely want to get into and talk more about here later. But before we discuss that, tell us a bit about your book, your latest book, Grand Deceptions. Is that released yet?
Yeah, that's actually the first book I ever published. It was put out in October of 2014, the first edition. And it's basically a treatise on Zionism. So it's sort of a compact study and overview and summary of a lot of the evidence of Zionist intrigue in the 20th and 21st centuries. So what I've done now is I'm putting out a second edition. So I've written two new chapters, brand new content, which amounts to about 60 new pages. So the book's quite short. It's like 143 pages, the first edition. And now with the updates, it's about over 200 pages, 600 footnotes. So the new content deals specifically with the issue of multiculturalism, the Frankfurt School, cultural Marxism, the Kalergi Plan. And then obviously the backstory with that and the main players involved in fomenting those things and pushing them forward into the 21st century. So that's the first new chapter. The second new chapter, I kind of do a broad overview of an up-to-date overview of the recent developments in the Middle East, the tying in the Oded Yunon plan with what happened to Sudan and Libya and Syria in terms of the internal artificial manufactured uprisings there, culminating in everything we're seeing today with ISIS and the insurgencies that have besieged these countries. And then I also detail what they have in store for Iran down the line. So I cover a lot of the, I tie in a lot of the Zionist intrigues and the geopolitical manifestos that have been put out recently, like the Brookings Institute put up this report called Which Path to Persia, which is basically a blueprint for regime change in Iran, where they literally listed five or six ways, tactics that they're looking to use to bring about an overthrow of the Iranian government. They detailed economic sanctions, an outright invasion, a military coup. They detailed sort of backing terrorists and insurgents against Iran, or just emboldening the minority factions in Iran as a sectarian gamut to break up the country and incite them to revolt. So these are strategies that they've used in Syria and Libya, in Iraq and Afghanistan throughout this entire Zionist neocon conspiracy, beginning with the 9/11 attacks, which I detail throughout the book. Most of the book, the first six chapters, deals with the Zionist origins of the war on terror and neoconservatism as a movement. It's entirely a Jewish Zionist movement geared towards strengthening Israel, creating a Zionist imperium in the Middle East, using the West and the United States in particular as a bulwark against the enemies of Israel, through and manufacturing all of this through manipulation, through media propaganda, and through primarily false flag terrorism, staging terrorism in order to hoodwink their ostensible allies, quote unquote, into fighting wars against their enemies and disorienting their enemies as well. And I detail some of the historical false flag operations of the Israeli state, going back to the King David Hotel bombing in 46, the Levant Affair, the USS Liberty. I also cover some lesser known false flags, like the one in Libya in 1986, which is called Operation Trojan. There was a bombing in Germany that same year that was blamed on Libya. It's actually the Mossad mm-hmm. and CIA that did it,
yep.
and that framed Germany, or framed Libya. There was another one in Africa. There's these embassy bombings that nobody really talks about because they're kind of obscure, and they happened in 1998. I found some very intriguing evidence that Israel was linked to those. And, of course, I have a big, big chapter on 9/11, the beneficiaries of it, and Israeli intelligence involvement in that as the new Pearl Harbor that the neocons have been yearning for and calling for as their casus belli to initiate this clash of civilizations that they'd been pontificating about in all of their propaganda outlets going back to 1979 with the Jonathan Institute conference in Israel, where the war on terror was actually conceived by Benjamin Netanyahu, and he's the number one guy who's been pushing it ever since. Every time there's a quote-unquote terrorist attack in the West, Netanyahu's on the pulpit screaming and yelling about how there needs to be more mobilization against the enemies of Israel. He's just a Machiavellian schemer. So the book is basically an intense summary of all those. It's quite short and concise, which is a lot of the good feedback I got was to the effect that it is so concise and so potent in putting together a lot of good evidence for these things and in a concise way. That's I guess one of my strengths is just summarizing information for average people who don't really know about this information, and this is just a good primer for them to get their feet wet, so to speak.
Yeah, it's a great asset. We need more material like that, of course, because people don't have the time in some cases. They don't know where to turn to kind of wade through all of this material and stuff, so that's an excellent resource to have. Now, I'd love to hear some more about Iran later. I think there's a really interesting development of what's happening there. But, you know, we spoke in, April 2015, almost a year ago, and a lot of things have happened since that time. Obviously, the so-called migrant crisis has really ramped up really over the summer there, so a few months after we spoke. Tell us about the first chapter, because obviously this kind of connects with this a bit about both Jewish supremacy, but also the multicultural experiment, which that is a tenant part of that we're seeing right now. Why did you want to, add this so early in the book as a second edition of the book? Why is this so important to you?
Well, the thing is what we're seeing today is a great polarization on two sides of this. So I've been very focused in the past 2 years, focusing on the misdeeds of Western governments in their foreign policy and deconstructing this whole Zionist neoconservative plan to reorder and reconfigure the Middle East, and they're committing some of the worst crimes of the 21st century have been perpetrated by these Western governments, and I've been on top of all that stuff. But what I'm noticing now is there's this kind of disconnect on both sides of this argument about migrants and immigration and multiculturalism. I have a lot of readers on my website and online media who are, I guess, what you would call more kind of leftist anti-Zionists, who are very in tune to that whole angle to things, but they kind of neglect and shirk the multiculturalism issue and some of the intrigues behind mass immigration, cultural Marxism, the Frankfurt School. They don't really want to look into that, and because not that they're hiding those things, it's just that it doesn't really fit with their mindset because they're so focused on exposing the crimes of the West at the moment, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there tends to be an ignorance on that end of those things, but there's also an ignorance on the other end where it's people who are focused entirely on deconstructing this whole mass immigration, multiculturalism issue, where they're kind of giving wrong-headed analysis of foreign policy, or they're just shirking it entirely and not talking about it, or just denying it completely. And actually, in some cases, I've seen people who call themselves alt-right or new right or whatever, actually defend some of these criminal foreign policies. So there seems to be an infiltration or subversion of both ends, where people are being told to talk about one thing and not the other, right? Whereas I'm trying to kind of meld the two things together, look at all of the information and all of the victims of globalism, and give them both their fair hearing, right? And bring the analysis to a synthesis where I'm actually describing the entire phenomenon and all of the agendas behind it. So that was the impetus behind the chapter, and I've written a few articles to that effect prior to putting out the second edition. One of them was the article called "Is the Migrant Crisis Part of a Zionist Plot Against White Europeans?" And the thing is, basically, you cannot please everybody in this movement, right?
No.
So I will have people who really respect my work on the Middle East and deconstructing Zionism and the foreign policy issue and false flag terrorism. But then they'll kind of give me feedback when I delve into some of this other stuff, and they'll say I've like betrayed the cause or something, and then, you know, you call me a white supremacist or whatever because I don't support mass immigration, which is itself a globalist, a tenet of globalism itself.
Of course. Yeah.
So a lot of these people on either end of these things, they're just shirking major aspects to what's going on, and they're building up like these two opposing camps where people are fighting each other and are very pissed off at each other based on some of their analysis. So I've just, you know, I don't really care if people are upset about what I'm writing. Are the facts correct? That's my only concern. Are the issues that I'm addressing real issues, and do they affect people? And that's basically what I've been trying to do. So with multiculturalism and Zionism, these are really kind of a two-headed hydra. You can't really divorce one from the other. You know, Zionism is intent not just on establishing a Jewish state for Jews around the world in Palestine, which they've done through blackmail and scheming and all of this Machiavellian strategizing that they've been engaged in, but they're simultaneously attempting to weaken everybody else. So in the Middle East, what are they doing? Well, they're breaking down their surrounding countries as per the Oded Yanom plan, as per sectarian fault lines, because that weakens them. But at the same time, they also have an agenda to weaken their other perceived enemies. I mean, these aren't even real enemies. These people are paranoid, so they view everybody as an enemy. But in the West, the majority are whites, Christians. So for century, they've been scheming and plotting to weaken us in the West, and they've done that through instigating wars like they do in the Middle East, but they've also done it, at least post-1945, they've been really ramping up this agenda to push mass immigration, multiculturalism, because this produces an environment that is conducive to their upward mobility or their just domination. So when there's a majority group out there that they view as a threat to their it's really a threat to their hegemony. They might act as if this is just about stamping out anti-Semitism, but that's not really the issue. They're not entirely concerned with anti-Semitism insofar as anti-Semitism is just, you know, a reaction to what they're doing. They're concerned with domination. It's not just about eliminating threats. It's about control. It's about power. In the Middle East, they're
because,
not...
Because ultimately that is eliminating the threat, right? If they can... because I hear, you know, a lot of people on the left say, for example, when you begin to talk about multiculturalism and immigration and stuff, they have an idea that, oh, you're, don't focus on the differences, right? You're dividing and conquering us. You know, you usually hear, but it's like, well, the bringing in of immigration is designed to divide and conquer us, right? To have a group, you know, homogenous and unified and pulling in the same direction, much like the Jewish community, right, that they manage to, despite their low numbers, when they work ethnically, when they orient themselves ethnically, they can get a tremendous amount of done for their own people. And obviously any other group that would do this, move in the same direction, that would undermine their very ability to dominate and to conquer, as you say.
Right. Right. So their activism is aimed at exploiting divisions and exacerbating those divisions and creating new divisions through promotion of identity politics, things like feminism, transgenderism, these new phenomena that have sprung out of the new left or what can be traced back to cultural Marxism, which is a byproduct of the Frankfurt School, which originated in Germany in 1923. It was established by a guy named Karl Grunsberg, who was a Jewish Marxist professor, and it was financed by a Jewish millionaire named Felix Weil. And essentially what the Frankfurt School was all about was sort of deconstructing the authoritarian personality of Western civilization or Western men specifically. And it doesn't entirely originate as like a post-World War II movement, because it was established before World War II, prior to Hitler coming to power. And they'd already been, you know, formulating these doctrines prior to this. So it's not something that sprung as a reaction to Hitler. It was actually pre-Hitler. And then they just kind of used Hitler as like their model bad guy to deconstruct, right?
Yeah.
But so most of these, almost all of the intellectuals, forebears of cultural Marxism in the Frankfurt School are Jewish. And the names here are, you know, Theodor Adorno, Max Horkheimer, Herbert Marcuse, Friedrich Pollock, Eric Fromm, Otto Kirchheimer, Leo Lowenthal, Franz Neumann. I mean, go down the list. All of them are Jewish. All of them are very strongly identifying Jews and Zionists. And so their agenda is quite obvious. It is to break down the cultural fabric of Western societies so that they do not lead into something that could resemble quote unquote fascism, or which is just a euphemism at this point for kind of Gentile nationalism, right?
Right.
So they're afraid of nationalism for all their peoples, right? They're the ones who stamped out nationalism for Palestinians. They stifle the self-determination of Palestinians. They carpet bomb them and drone bomb them and use white phosphorus and then demonize them in the media. So they're against nationalism for all Gentiles, white or non-white, doesn't matter, whoever they view as a competitor. But then they're all for nationalism for themselves, because that makes them strong. That builds up their, quote, in-group loyalty. But they're all about breaking that down for other groups, because it's part of their group evolutionary strategy or whatever.
Yep.
To advance themselves, advance their power, advance their interests. And not all Jews are involved in the Frankfurt School. Obviously not, right? These are a select group of very active and extremely paranoid and schizophrenic, I would say, Jewish elites that have committed themselves to this movement, which infiltrated a lot of the universities in the United States post-World War II. Hitler actually kicked them out of Germany. They burrowed their way into like Columbia University.
Yes.
And other places in the U.S. That became the hub, the center of cultural Marxist activity in the U.S., and then all these other movements started to spring from that, like the New Left and that whole sexual revolution and everything involved with that.
You know, let me just add something there. I was actually not too long ago, I actually visited Columbia University. You know, I think they came over to New York in 1935 after it was the Institute of Social Research that moved, obviously, you know, in 33 when Hitler came to power, as you said. And it was amazing to just walk around on the grounds there to see how, you know, both the people, but also the, you know, the power, I guess, of the architecture, the dominance of just, you know, the those structures, the buildings that were on the site, right? And it was amazing to just kind of realize how this powerful kind of, at the time, elite school have really been turned into a mechanism of this cultural Marxism, when at some point the school represented really the high point, I'd say, to a certain extent, of Western civilization. And you had, you know, statues, and you had, you know, inscriptions all over the school, and, you know, with a focus on wisdom and philosophy and, you know, study and all this stuff. And it was just amazing to see also actually how few white people there were at the school anymore. It was like almost that they were completely replaced. Sure, I was just there for one day, but what I saw, it was like there was hardly any white people left in the school anymore. It's remarkable the way they managed to upturn or overturn an institution like this very elite Gentile school, and to make it and turn it into what it is today, you know.
Right, and I think that also applies to most of the major Ivy League schools, Harvard, Princeton, all these, all these schools have been hijacked, and they're now just basically havens for either cultural Marxism, or they also use those schools to recruit dirtbags for the CIA and other elite organizations. Now, two of the main guys here that were involved with the Frankfurt School were Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer. These are the intellectual godfathers of the movement, and they wrote all the books, basically all the literature that was used as the foundation for cultural Marxism. The one main book is called The Authoritarian Personality, right? And even the Wikipedia page for this book identifies Adorno as his motivation for writing the book as, quote, the Holocaust, right? So the study that he put out, this book was produced by this group called Studies in Prejudice, which was sponsored, as Wikipedia admits, by the American Jewish Committee's Department of Scientific Research.
Yep.
So the motivations and the impetus, it's not even as if they're trying to hide it. Perhaps they do try to hide it in some ways, but in other ways they don't. He explicitly attempts in the book to delegitimize what he calls fascist or anti-Semitic tendencies in Western male psyche, right? So he also continued on that theme in other essays. Like in 1947, he wrote an essay called Wagner, Nietzsche, and Hitler. 1950, he's got an essay called Freudian Theory and the Pattern of Fascist Propaganda. And it's amazing because they're the ones who are the experts in propaganda, and Edward Bernays and all these guys. These were mostly Jews, and they're the ones leading the propaganda efforts today.
Yep.
In every possible theater, whether it's neoconservatism or cultural Marxism or Zionism or warmongering in the Middle East. So they're the champions of propaganda and deconstructing other people and pointing out the flaws in other people, which they're doing today against Muslims because they're the targets in the Middle East. So the neocons are basically cultural Marxists as well. They just do it in a phony conservative cloak, but their main impetus and their main attack is on this deconstructing Islamic cultures, right? It's they're mean to gays and they're mean to women. These are things that they're pushing here too, with feminism and gay rights and transgenderism. These are all things that are designed to break down cultures, traditional cultures, right? To deconstruct these cultures, to weaken them and elevate the weakest elements in society and make them the actual rulers, right? So the weakest elements being, you know, minorities or homosexuals or women. Now they're becoming the thought leaders. They're becoming the politicians who are running the government.
Yeah.
They're becoming the media moguls now. They're the thought leaders, and they're doing that to the Muslim world. They're doing that to the Western world. They're doing that to anyone that they view as an impediment to their agenda. Now I go into, there's a long section in that chapter, the new chapter on the clergy plan, right? The clergy plan for Europe. When people talk about the white genocide phenomenon, it's not necessarily, when people think of genocide, they think of violent killing, right? But it's not necessarily the case. It doesn't have to be violent. It could be through immigration. It could be through intermixing, right? Because genocide simply means destroying the genes, right?
Yep. As long as it's planned, right? As long as it's a concerted effort by someone to, you know, replace the group or to transfer the children of them, or I mean, certainly an element or level of targeting them with violence as well. But it's like a long term ethnic cleansing kind of thing, and that is by definition genocide.
And it says in whole or in part. Right.
Yeah.
So that is what is happening. It's happening in two places. It's happening in the Middle East more directly, more physically through bombing and carpet bombing and destruction, that's a more direct approach that they've taken to the Middle East, because those are the direct enemies of Israel, physical enemies. Where in the West, it's more of a cultural war, it's more of a psychological war, and it's also being waged through mass immigration and propaganda that's used to promote quote-unquote diversity or race mixing or whatever. These are all things that are acting simultaneously and designed to produce the effect of dissolution of the ethnic homogeneity, as Peter Sutherland, the globalist, actually came out directly and said, we want to undermine the national homogeneity of European countries.
Yeah, that's right.
Directly stating the agenda, the goal. So when I'm pointing to evidence like that, I'm not a white supremacist for pointing that out. He's the one who said that. It's his goal to destroy Europe. It's just a fact, and we should oppose it because it's a destructive and evil plan.
Yeah.
Just as we oppose these evil wars that are also destructive and evil and
harmful.
Well,
it shows, Brandon, I think, the tremendous success, and I think a kind of a foundational work in terms of propaganda that has been laid when it comes to, as you say, you can point out this plan and say, you know, I'm not saying it, they are, look at what this is doing. But even that as a recognition is considered to be, you know, quote, white supremacist, right, or whatever, meaning that even you in defense of your own group, if you're white, is seen as a crime, really. It's seen as something which is so immoral, so reprehensible, that if you attach yourself to that, you are, you know, you're belonging to this group that they have been programming us for such a long time about, fascists or anybody who is white just looking after your own interest. I find it remarkable how, you know, people can see that. They can even be fairly tuned in to conspiracy or to the geopolitical game, or even to, as you said, what they are doing in Palestine or whatnot. But as soon as you flip the coin and show that other side of it, they want nothing to do with it, which I think indicates to me that they're victims of this same group's propaganda that we've been talking about.
Right. It's been very stigmatized, deliberately so, and there's been massive money that's been poured into doing that, into promoting these memes and narratives that delegitimize basically only the self-determination of Europeans and not of any other group. So one of the critiques I'd have of people who are very anti-imperialist, and I am as well, and I would consider myself a fellow traveler in that respect, but they will champion all the self-determinations of all of the third world peoples, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, Palestinians, they have a right to self-determination. Everybody in the global south has a right to self-determination, but not whites.
Right. Yeah.
But this is part of this, like, cultural Marxist narrative that only whites can't look out for their own, or can't have a nation, can't be homogenous. Everybody else can. India is, you know, like 90% Indian, China 90% Chinese, Japan 95% Japanese, North and South Korea like 98% Korean, Africa is mostly African. I mean, there's some white people there, I guess, in South Africa, but all of these peoples are able to have their countries, right?
Yeah.
There's been interference and oppression, and globalism has destroyed a lot of those countries as well, but they're also destroying Europe too. It's not like Europe is like outside of the crosshairs of globalism.
Well, I'd say, Brandon, sorry to interrupt, but I'd say that in some regards, some of the European countries were actually targeted of this first, right? They became the vehicle and the mechanism, partially, of course, because of our ability technologically to extend ourselves the way we did into other countries, and thereby extending our influence and our, you know, politics, financial, you know, issues and whatnot. But the overtaking of various European nations in terms of the elite we're talking about here, that goes way back, and I'd say that happened in Europe before, you know, many other places, at least in the modern times, you know.
Right. There's a divide and conquer gambit in the Middle East, spearheaded by Zionists, but there was also a divide and conquer gambit in Europe going back to the First World War, the Second World War, the 30 Years' War.
Yep.
Plenty of examples where Europeans have also been used and oftentimes hoodwinked and used as the vehicles or the agents or the foot soldiers of Zionism and globalism in various wars. I mean, there's definitely a case to be made that these European countries are the leading vessels, or at least the United States now is a leading vessel facilitating the aims of Zionism, no question about
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
But the people in the country, the average people, the working class people, didn't come up with these things. They're just,
and they didn't benefit from it either. Menike, look at Britain, for example. You hear that all the time, right? But there's like a tremendous underclass in Britain that it's like there's old ladies that are freezing to death, you know. And despite that, somehow the advantages and the white privilege of colonialism is projected upon them, which is utterly nonsensical, ridiculous.
Well, one of the first victims of colonialism were Irish people that were actually taken to the New World as indentured, quote unquote, indentured servants as slaves. So they're average people are also used in these gambits. It's always just a tiny little elite crust that benefits from whether it's imperialism today or colonialism of yesteryear. But even if these people did benefit, are their descendants also guilty? Is there such a thing as generational guilt? I mean,
yeah, I guess
so. If your father is a murderer, it doesn't make you a murderer, right?
Right.
We wouldn't apply this on a personal level, but it's somehow applied to entire races, which is very strange. So I don't believe in collective guilt. Okay, even if these countries were the most evil in the world, I mean, we can point to examples of other groups committing similar acts throughout history. That doesn't justify them being destroyed today. We can all have our own spaces, our own areas, and preserve our history and culture and everything, and not be at war with each other and basically live in peace. But the globalists and the Zionists don't want that. So they're forcing these things onto us. They're putting us into these opposing camps, pushing us against each other, creating this destabilization everywhere in the Middle East and in Europe. And it's all part of this master plan, which traces back to Richard von Kutenhove-Kalergi, who is the founder of the Pan-Europa movement. He wrote the seminal text, the Pan-Europa book, in 1923. And he was a guy that was the son of an Austrian diplomat and a Japanese mother. And he was basically the front man for the dissolution of Europe as we know it today. And he actually pontificated this and articulated this in many of his texts and speeches, and he promoted openly the mixing of all the different races together to produce what he called a Eurasian Negroid race. So that's Europeans, Asians, Negroid, all into one globalist slave race with no culture, with no roots, no attachments, and this would be ruled over, according to Kalergi, according to his own words. I didn't make this up. He said to the spiritual nobility, who he identified as Jews, and he actually said in one of his books that Jews represented a brain aristocracy, that they have a superiority of spirit, that they will lead this new government in Europe over this slave race with no culture and no attachments, and he described them as a spiritual nobility. So he was a Jewish supremacist, so Jews would maintain their very exclusivist tribalist culture and keep their group pure because they're racist. They ban intermarriage in Israel, and they're against mixing for their group, but then they're promoting it for all the other groups. So
yeah.
What's the end goal? What's the end game here? Well, we're all weak and divided and we're acculturated, and they are as strong and powerful as they be, as united and cohesive as they could possibly be, and they'll be the overseers of this new Europe, the United States of Europe. And one of the articles I found here, which I included an excerpt from, was from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency from 1926. And it was reporting on Kalergi's conference that he had this year. And the article is called Jews Participate in Pan-Europe Congress Sessions in Vienna. And it said, quote, several Jewish European leaders took a prominent part in the first Pan-European Congress, which opened here on Sunday, when the movement to establish the United States of Europe, modeled after the United States of America, took definite shape. It says many individual European Jews are furthering the Pan-European movement by giving it financial support. And it named a few of them, Leon Blum, Luziati, George Brandes, Harry Warburg. And it said, Kudinov Kalergi is married to Ida Roland, a Jewess, which it says in here. And then it said, it quoted him as saying that the creation of a United States of Europe would be beneficial to the Jews as it would eliminate racial hatred and economic rivalry. In other words, it would eliminate any opposition to Jews and would elevate them to an economic overclass.
Wow.
It's just so brazen. And he was actually admitted in his autobiography that Max Warburg was the chief financier of his movement, the German Jewish banker whose brother, Paul Warburg, became the head of the Federal Reserve Bank in the United States, or the founder of it.
Yep.
And also he was friends with Louis Baron von Rothschild. So he was the head of the Austrian branch of the Rothschild family. And he was also backed by the Freemasonic movements. He was a Freemason himself. Freemasonry is basically Judaism for Gentiles. So he got tremendous, tremendous support from the leadership of the Jewish financial elite and the Masonic elite. And then he actually encountered a similar fate as the Frankfurt School, in that he was actually chased out of Europe by Hitler. And he took root in the United States, continued to promote his pan-European project. So he would kind of talk in these universalist terms where he would say, oh, we need a united Europe to prevent wars, right? Sort of the narrative that they advocate for a global government. They say, oh, well, if there's a global government, there'll be no more wars, right? So let's just, let's just sacrifice sovereignty in the name of some greater good. So these are the kind of tricks and deceptive lingo that's thrown out there to convince us to get on board with these globalist plans, right?
It's remarkable, and actually much of his proposals too have actually come into fruition. There's still a kind of a Kalergi prize that's actually handed out to politicians that have been obviously instrumental in bringing into fruition, you know, the tenets that he was considering at the time. Even symbolic things such as, for example, suggesting the Ode to Joy as the national anthem of Europe of sorts. He suggested initially the flag, the 12 stars, for example. He had a little bit of a different symbol for the pan-European movement. It was basically a red, kind of a Templar cross within a sun or something, a yellow circle, but this transformed later on. So it's not like he was a small player at the time, and certainly afterwards, a lot of Europeans, so-called the founding fathers, have paid tribute, if you will, to him and to his ideas. So I definitely think we're right when we're saying that he kind of laid the groundwork, ideologically speaking, for what later developed into Europe.
Right. The European Union is very much founded upon his principles that he laid out in his text, and he advocated openly and promoted. And all of their underlying doctrines basically follow along with what he was saying. I mean, he was advocating for the mixing of all the different races. And what did we see happening? Well, the European Union is leading the effort to bring in masses of foreign people into Europe. And then there's also a speech given by Nicolas Sarkozy in 2008 where he advocated racial interbreeding, and he said that this would be forced upon people, and if they didn't want it or didn't go along with it, that more coercive measures would be used to enforce that this happened. So what we see is the entire European elite are Kalergiites. They're following the Kalergi plan. Angela Merkel, David Cameron, this phony rhetoric they put out here that multiculturalism is a failure. They put that out in around 2008 or something. They all simultaneously said that. they only put that out there to pacify people, to make it look like they're not actually behind this, that they're not actually supporting this.
Yeah.
All of those three politicians have led the effort to inundate their countries with mass immigration. I mean, David Cameron, 330,000 immigrants have been coming in every year annually into Britain under David Cameron's neoconservative government. Sarkozy, the same thing, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of immigrants every year coming into France. I think 20% of the actual population of France is foreigner in ethnicity. Germany, Merkel is the one who opened the floodgates to a million refugees, right?
Yeah.
So they're lying when they're saying they're against multiculturalism or that it's a failure. Really, it's kind of confusing when people hear multiculturalism. It's not necessarily what they want. They want an interbred, acculturated mass who have no culture. So it's not going to be cultures sitting side by side. It's going to be no culture, right? It's going to be the globalist slave popular culture of consumerism, right? That's what they want.
Ruthless.
So Islamic cultures are also an impediment to that, which is why they're promoting cultural Marxism in the Islamic world as well. They're promoting, you know, these reformists or so-called reformists that are trying to liberalize the religion, because this will allow feminism and homosexual rights and so forth. Now, I think Islam basically takes that cultural conservatism too far, I would say. They're too far on the one end, but then the cultural Marxists are way too far on the other end, right? So I think that the best ideal scenario would be somewhere in the middle, right, that allows a lot of the freedoms that we have in the West, but doesn't elevate, like, gays and minorities and transgenders and all this stuff into positions of power or elevate them into this, like, sacrosanct status that they have now under cultural Marxism. So that is an impediment to globalism as well. So they want to break down all traditional cultures, whether it's Arab Islamic cultures or Hindu culture in India or other cultures. They want to break down all these things because they're all an impediment to globalism. But at the same time, I think it's really only the white ethnic groups that are being specifically targeted for a genocidal end game, right? Because African populations are exploding. The Indian population is exploding. The Chinese have to do a one-child policy because they're having too many kids, too much population. So it's really only the white ethnic group that is declining in number and is being facilitated every step of the way by these Kalergiite leaders that are in power in Europe. One of the guys who actually spoke out about this was Nick Griffin, who is the head of the BNP, and he actually stood up in the European Parliament and called out this entire thing. He talked about Kalergi. He says an elite cabal of leftist capitalists and Zionist supremacists are the architects of ethnocide in Europe, that they're promoting immigration and miscegenation with a deliberate aim of breeding us out of existence in our own homelands. He says this is a genetic modification industry, and that they come up with various excuses like temporary guest workers, multiracial experiment, refugees, etc., etc. These are pretexts that are used to justify the mass immigration. So that you'll notice today they talk about, you know, like a declining population, we need to replace this with other people, right? Well, why do you have to do that? Just because your population isn't growing exponentially, you have to bring more people in. Well, why is that the case? I don't understand.
No, it's ridiculous. But what do you see? I mean, it's this is what's happening, no doubt. But obviously, what they are seeking at the end goal to be is obviously not something that's coming into fruition right now. This is actually working in the opposite direction. This is creating a tremendous divide, not only, of course, between the immigrant groups and the native European people, but it's also, of course, dividing between the native people who are, you know, pro-immigration or anti-immigration, who over this question actually are divided, right? They have families, relationships, things like that are actually breaking apart because some people are not liking it and others are, and this is, you know, leading to chaos in that regard. But my point is, why are they seeking to bring in not only Muslims, there's others too, but millions of non-Europeans into Europe that are very kind of, I think, once they get to Europe, they become very hardened in their own religion and cultural association. In many cases, they cling on to it even more than someone in, for example, the country they came from would do, for obvious reasons, right? They feel ostracized, they might feel that they don't belong, etc., but this is causing tremendous strife. And it surely at this point isn't leading, very few instances, I think, to this, the mixing, this interbreeding that the Kalergi and this other elite are hoping for. How are they seeking to use this, do you think? The hardened relationship between these groups to at the end of it, eventually bring it to that point when all of Europeans say, oh my God, we got to stop this horrible violence and everything. Let's just kind of blend and merge together so that, again, it will lead to peace or something. Or how do you think they're hoping this to play out?
Well, I think they're always adapting, right, to different situations, to the crisis that they've created, the manufactured crisis that they facilitated on purpose. And one of the reasons that they're bringing in masses of particularly Muslim Middle Easterners, one, it's basically what they've done is it's a consequence. They've mobilized the consequences of their imperial wars, right? They've done this Oded Yanon plan, fracturing these countries, promoting sectarianism. They've invaded a few of the countries. In other cases, they've covertly sponsored and spawned insurgencies and fed those insurgencies with weapons and money. And they've caused all these refugees and displaced people, right, in certain areas. And they're basically weaponizing those same people that they are responsible for uprooting and using them to facilitate this other agenda in Europe. And they're pushing them into Europe. They don't have to do that. I mean, these migrants were sitting in Turkey and Jordan for a few years, from around 2012 to 2015. They were in refugee camps in Turkey, but then all of a sudden they were pushed into Europe. That was not an accident. That was deliberate. And, one of the outcomes of this is further polarization between the West and the Islamic world, which, of course, plays into the hands of the neoconservatives and the Zionists, who have always been trying to promote this idea about a clash of civilizations and a confrontation that is largely manufactured, and maybe there's some organic elements to it historically, but in terms of today's context, it is almost entirely manufactured through false flag terrorism, engineered wars, and now engineered mass migration that they are promoting and facilitating, as George Soros said. He declared that 1 million refugees need to be accepted into the EU every year, and that his organizations are basically financing it and promoting it. And Peter Sutherland has declared that Europe needs to literally open its borders completely to anyone who wants to come into Europe. And what this does is since these migrants are majority Muslim, the nationalist backlash to that is being completely hijacked by Zionists and neocons and other elements that have actually foreseen that this would happen and put their agents in place in order to steer the dissent. So we have groups like the English Defense League and Pegida and Geert Wilders and others who are overtly Ziocons. They wave Israeli flags at their parades, at their protests.
Yep.
They're openly pro-Israel. They support neoconservative foreign policies of intervention and war in the Islamic world. They focus all of their attention entirely 100% of the time on Islam. They have nothing else to say about any other issue, and that is the desired goal of these groups. And Nick Griffin actually gave a good anecdote at a speech. He said in 2007, neocon Jews tried to bribe the BNP, him and the BNP, and they told him, it was quite simple. They said, don't talk about Zionism. Don't talk about Israel. Don't talk about the origins of the European Union, who's behind mass immigration, who's promoting this. Only talk about Islam. Only bash Islam, because it benefits Israel. Israel's enemies are now our enemies. We're seeing the world through their spectacles. So this has clearly been, this is a sort of like a game theory gambit where they've sort of weighed all the options of this, and they decided moving specifically Muslims into Europe will increase this polarization between West and between West and East, between Christianity and Islam. And this, of course, who benefits from this? Well, Israel rises out of the chaos of this engineered manufactured confrontation as the leading state in the world. And you can go in on the internet and look up Benjamin Netanyahu. He says Israel must become the leading power. Literally, he says Israel must become the leading state in the world that will literally trump even all the big Western powers at the end of this. Now, there's a great polarization that's happening. So basically, we're being asked to either be like 100% for refugees or 100% against, to be 100% against Islam or 100% for it, right? So there's always this dialectical thing going on. It's either you're in this two extreme camps, you're either in one or the other. They're not allowing any room for a middle ground, right? So in the case of mass immigration of Muslims, obviously this isn't desirable in any kind of sensible way, that you have a different people with a different religion and a different culture moving in mass numbers. This is just isn't desirable, whether it's Muslims or Hindus or Africans or whatever. I mean, the religion doesn't really matter. It's even if they were all atheists, it would still be undesirable, right?
Right, right.
Just based on the ethnic and cultural differences, just based on the fact that European countries cannot maintain their culture and civilization if there's a mass influx of other people, regardless of who they are, right?
Right.
Regardless of their religion. So they're trying to steer that fact and put it entirely into just attacking Islam. Obviously, there's negative things about Islam. There's negative things about Christianity and obviously Judaism and all religion. But the point is that they're really trying to get these groups to be pro war in a sense and pro Israel. And
well, it paints them into a corner, Brad, to a certain extent, right? That's what it's designed to do. Some of these groups that are rising now to kind of suck up the discontent, the understandable discontent of the native European population, they seem to frown on Islam because, you know, as you said, they think it's too conservative. I mean, there's extremist element within it, even excluding the false flag issue. There's plenty of, as we discussed this last time too, there's plenty of violence and rape that is occurring, and these things are actually not lifted forward in the media that you would think it would be if they were seeking to use that to slam Islam, right? It's almost that some of these issues, they put the lid on, they try to cover it up. We even have code 291 in Sweden, where the police is actively, if a crime has been committed by a migrant or immigrant, whatever, then they actively are trying to cover it up, not to bring attention to it, because it will further cause, you know, rifts and discontent, right? So they're very picky and choosy in terms of what they pick. But my point is, these groups that are rising now, it seems that basically they are liberalized Westerners, right? They have the objection to the fact that many Islamists are they're hard on the, you know, promotion of homosex or whatever, right? That they want those Western values which have made us progressive and soft, and they see that they stand in the way of it. There was this one video of the Pegida meetings in UK with Tommy Robinson and Paul Weston, that the speeches they made on a kind of the relaunch of Pegida, which was quite interesting to watch actually, and they were tremendously friendly, if you will, to multiculturalism. They were talking about how all these people are coming to the UK. There was this old general, he was like some paratrooper or something, I think, old guy who participated in the Second World War, I believe. And he was like talking about how wonderful it was with this multiculturalism in the UK and how we all have benefited from it. But there's just this one group that doesn't want to adapt and fit in, basically. And that was the Islamists, right? So it's very, in my view, very antithetical to this idea that it's actually the destruction of the homogeneity of the population that is the problem, not whether they come attached with one religion or another. Sure, the effects of it might be more, extreme to that extent, and the conflicts, the cultural collision, if you will, is more, more noticeable if it's Islam versus, let's say, more an atheist or progressive lefty or something in the West, right? But this is what they're seeking to do, right? They're seeking to say that everything is fine. It's just these horrible Muslims right. that refuse to fit in because they're just too conservative for the West.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, in England, I think one of the main immigrant groups is Afro-Caribbeans. Right. They're not Muslims, but these people are fine with these kind of mass immigration coming from other parts of the world that aren't Islamic, because Islamic culture and just political thought is anti-Zionist, is antithetical to cultural Marxism, is probably the most conservative religion in the world, and there's certain elements within it that go way too far, like the Wahhabis, Salafists, who are the main group that whenever these neocons critique Islam, that they're actually talking about Wahhabis, but then they're applying that to the entire religion. I mean, women are pretty liberated in countries like Iran. I mean, they have, they hold public office. There's political posts for specifically for minority religious factions. They're quite tolerant and so forth. It's really just the Wahhabist Salafists that they're talking about, and those are the main troublemakers that you see being bandied around on television, like Anjan Chowdhury, who's an MI5 plant, whose group actually was created by MI5, and him and his cult followers are 100% protected by the British state. How can this guy go around exhorting people to join Islamic State and still be free? Right? They're allowing him to do this because he's a scarecrow that the neocons roll out to convince everybody that Islam is a scary, evil thing. But it's a dialectical thing because they're sponsoring extremists like that on one end. They're also funding the EDL and the opposition to that, who only point to that and try to use that as some excuse to say all Muslims are bad and we need to be fighting wars for Israel, right?
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah, let's not take care of the problem in our countries, right? Look at the Paris attacks. Seemingly, you'd say on the official level, then they say, oh my God, this is bringing in problems. Let's close the borders and make sure that this discontinues. No, that's not what they do. The first thing they did was to, you know, issue a go-ahead to bomb Syria, right? It's like, wait a minute, this is going to, bring more problem to the region, which is going to bring more and drive more migrants to the West.
And it's so completely orchestrated on both ends. With Paris, they absolutely allowed it to happen. In fact, there's no possible way these guys could have entered Europe. They're all tagged on terror watch lists and were well known. The one guy in from Belgium, his name is Abdelhamid Aboud, was literally a household name in Belgium, and they actually charged him in absentia before this attack. So he was his wanted poster was literally everywhere in Belgium prior to this attack. Well known, he was in ISIS magazine interviews. He's everywhere. And somehow he just takes a chartered flight to Paris and gets all the weapons, and so they allow it to happen. The French government was funding all the rebel groups in Syria since 2012. Hollande was fully backing the rebels in Syria, and then they cry foul when it comes back, and they allow that to happen. So it's so dialectical. They're creating the terror themselves, or at least allowing it to happen, funding it, and so forth. And then they're using it as an excuse to do more intervention, more war, more bombing in the Middle East, which produces more migrants, and then it just feeds itself, right? These two things feed each other at the same time.
Yeah.
So they want you to be pro-war and anti-Muslim, but then they want you also to be pro-immigration and pro-refugee. So it's very confusing to people, and then they have a hard time trying to explain these things to people. But that's almost the state that they want things in. They want confusion.
Yeah, yeah.
They want chaos, right?
Well, the more you can't wrap your head around it, I think the more kind of desperate people become to turn to the authorities on the issue. Like, wait a minute, what am I supposed to think about this, right? It gives them a perfect setup, and it also creates, I've mentioned this many times before on the show, but it creates a very schizophrenic relationship to these events that are occurring. Take 9/11, for example. We don't have to linger too much on that right now, but just as an example, right? Officially, Muslims did it, right? But you have to, you know, if you're against building a mosque on ground zero, you're a racist, right? It's horrible with Islamophobia in America, but we need to go bomb them over there, right? It's like, wait a minute, it's remarkable how they managed to pull this off, but they have, you know.
It's a schizophrenic narrative that's being foisted on us. And it feeds into all of their agenda simultaneously. So they want to promote multiculturalism, so then they'll do these phony things about Islamophobia, but then at the same time they're actually promoting that you hate Muslims because they want you to fight and kill them for Israel. So, yeah. And at the same time, that doesn't even consider all the false flag shenanigans going on and all the foreign policy gambits involved in this. So, especially with the migrant crisis, really, you know, the best solution I think I've worked out is that, look, the three Western governments that are the most responsible for this are France, Britain, and the United States, who have absolutely been funding and fueling all of these rebel groups and insurgencies, including ISIS, which was cultivated out of these dupes that were pulled out of American prison camps in Iraq in 2006, including al-Baghdadi, who was literally a go-to guy for the U.S. military in their prison camp. They orchestrated this. They built them up. They used these Gulf puppet regimes that they control and that don't really act on their own unless they get the green light, because they're basically glorified U.S. military bases. But the Gulf states have been providing all the funding and covert support at the behest of the United States, at the behest of Israel, right? So it's sort of they delegated downwards different roles to their puppet regimes in the region. But as far as refugees are concerned, look, they would be better off in countries surrounding Syria. One, they're closer to Syria, so they'll be able to go home when the war's over. Two, they share a religion and a culture with those surrounding countries. They can assimilate very easily, right? They don't have to learn a new language. They already speak Arabic in these countries, right? The fact is, Arabic is spoken throughout all those countries, right? It's a unifying factor in the Middle East, except perhaps Turkey and Iran. But they would do much better there than in Europe. How are they going to get a job in Europe? They don't even speak German. They don't speak these languages. There's no way they can survive in Europe, right? Europe is already denigrated, economically speaking. People in Europe can't even find jobs themselves. How are these migrants who don't speak English, who don't speak German, who don't speak Spanish going to survive in these environments?
No, they're just going to become a drain on the system, and it's going to further aggravate people, understandably, you know.
And at the same time, the money issue, okay, I think that the French government, the British government, the American government should pay for should pay at least some part of this issue to resettle these refugees in surrounding countries, or pay for their living expenses. Not the taxpayer money, though, because the taxpayers didn't do this. The average citizens did not advocate for these criminal, insane policies in the Middle East. It's the elites that did that. It's the neocons. It's the Blairs and the Bushes and the Camerons and the Sarkozys, right?
Yeah.
They should pay. They should pay out of pocket. And also the Gulf states, those Gulf states that are financing ISIS, that are financing all the insurgents that have besieged these countries, they should pay. They're filthy rich, right? These are filthy rich oil sheikdoms, these corrupt oil barons. And what are they doing? They haven't taken in a single refugee, right? Because that is part of the plan. The plan is send them to Europe, right?
Yeah.
So it's all being orchestrated. And there's such simple solutions to these things that make sense and are good, basically are looking out for everybody involved, the migrants and Europeans, right? But they don't want these solutions, because these solutions do not coincide with their genocidal agenda, which is to literally erase Europe as a continent and to destroy the Islamic world and reshape it, reshuffle it in the interest of Israel. It's a sick criminal plan.
Well, Brandon, let's take a break right here. Much more we want to discuss or talk about here. I definitely have some more issues I want to bring up in terms of Kalergi and actually how some of his suggestions in terms of this moral supremacist bunch of people, how they've actually managed to manifest this in Europe. I'll mess with some of these organizations in the next segment here. But tell us about the websites that you run, that you're behind. Obviously, we've been talking here about Grand Deceptions. It's not your latest book, then. That's my mistake in the beginning there. But obviously, it's a second edition with this kind of material updated in it. Tell us how people can get a copy of this book.
So the second edition is almost done. It will be up, available on Amazon and CreateSpace within the next week. And I'm going to be making a post on nonalignedmedia.com where I'll give an overview of some of the new updates with the book and detail some of the additions. And that's all available on nonalignedmedia.com, and I'll have a link to that book permanently on the sidebar there.
All right, very good. Nonalignedmedia.com. You also have, I believe, martinezperspective.com, right?
Right. Martinez Perspective is just the repository for all of my articles and essays. The main blogging venue is Nonaligned Media, where you can catch my updates.
ISIS Conspiracy, is that still available too?
Yeah, the ISIS Conspiracy and Hidden History, these are the two other anthologies that I put out. They're both available on Amazon and CreateSpace, and you can find the links for those on Nonaligned Media.
We'll have some links up to those folks, so definitely check out the website if you want to get direct links to that. All right, we'll take a break right here. We'll be back with Brandon Martinez. Stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back. So we'll proceed in the second hour, another great segment coming up with Brandon Martinez, where we further discuss and clarify some of the issues that we are currently struggling with when it comes to the migration crisis and how to awaken people to the issues of what really is going on behind the scenes. Now, specifically in the second hour, we discuss how to communicate with people who can only see the first layer of the problem and get them to not only see the symptoms but the roots of this issue. We talk about the people that Kalergi envisioned to be the moral guiding light of the pan-European movement and the extension the European Union. As we list the organizations that have been created already to facilitate this, I think we can safely say that his vision has actually come into fruition. We discuss the Yinian plan, Greater Israel, and how they've been overplaying their hand in recent years. We also speculate if there's an opportunity to forge partnerships with the people in other parts of the world who understand the detrimental effects of globalism and also appreciate that we have a common enemy. We talk more about Pegida, UK, and other kosher nationalist groups, and although it's obviously a step in the right direction, it's not a movement that I think is enough if we are to not only understand, but also to defeat the forces that have created the conditions that have given rise to these nationalist groups. The need for them is clear, but in what direction should they go? We discuss the war in Syria towards the end, and also what we need to do to become competitive in the war of ideology and information that is waging right now for the hearts and minds of people in Europe and the West. Great second hour coming up. Please stay tuned. The website where you can hear the rest is redicemembers.com. That's where we have all our shows archived in full, going back to 2006, coming up on 10 years here soon, over 1,000 shows, a lot for you to dig into there. So if you want to get access, sign up for a membership and you can stream or download all of our shows, including the videos, inside episodes, films, and much more that we have available there for you. By the way, we have some good shows coming up here. Dr. Stephen Flowers, a.k.a. Edred Thorsson, we're going to talk about how to restore the Indo-European religion. We also have Stefan Jakobsson from the Party of the Swedes, Frank Raymond to discuss his book Sweet Dreams and Terror Cells. We also have Utar Vinis about the Uera Linda book. Very interesting find that I recently discovered about the Frisians and old European civilizations, kind of a chronology of the origins of many European tribes and the movement of them. It's also been called Himmler's Bible, by the way. Interesting stuff. We'll break right here. We'll be right back with Brandon Martinez. Please stay tuned. Second hour coming up, redicemembers.com. We'll see you there.